Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. First thing that I thought we should talk about is something that I picked up recently from reading my favorite French newspaper, Le Monde, which, by the way, is how I keep my blood pressure down nowadays. I only read what Le Monde thinks is important to print about our president, and that narrows it down substantially. However, I feel like they probably have pretty good judgment about what actually matters. And this was something that they thought actually mattered, and I totally agree. So first of all, let me tell you what happened. This is a bit of a pharmaceutical scandal, and we have to go back to about 2017, and that's when Merck introduced a new formulation of their very widely distributed thyroid drug, which is Levothyrox. This is like levothyroxine, and it was being reformulated. It's important to understand that whenever one reformulates a drug, it has to go through a regulatory system and be evaluated to see whether or not it meets a standard. And in the case of thyroid hormone, which is what we're talking about, it has to be bioequivalent. And the definition of that's fairly lenient, actually. The new formula has to give you a blood level of the drug that is at least plus or minus 10% of what is obtained with the old formulation. So that's a pretty substantial variation. A lot of times we use a plus or minus 5% when, in fact, the entry point for getting a generic onto the market in this country for the FDA is a plus or minus 5% bioavailability compared to the existing proprietary agent. And, of course, regular listeners will remember that we've talked all about how that generic transition at the 17-year mark can be gamed. But, hey, we're talking about Europe. And I always thought that, well, you know, if there's anything I can rely upon the Europeans to be a little more strict. Well, apparently not so much. They cut corners too. And what happened was that the National Agency for Drug Safety, ANSM in French, just took the data that Merck provided and looked at it and said, okay, fine. And they did not carry out an independent analysis of the data. And the reason we know this is because once this new version of Levothyrox went live, a whole bunch of people who were taking thyroid started to have real problems. And these problems constituted the problems with just it not working. For some people, it was too strong, very Goldilocks here, and they got sort of rapid heartbeat and feeling nervous and anxious. Other people, it was too weak, and they were not necessarily having the effect that they need from this drug. So this sort of suggested that maybe it was failing the bioequivalence test. But the first thing that happened here was that the drug company said, well, of course this is nonsense. This is the nocebo effect, it being the era of the internet. Of course, people were complaining on the internet, and the companies said to the doctors, look, this is just an internet meme. It's not real. People are imagining this. They don't think their drug's going to work, so indeed it doesn't work. And this reminds me so much of the sorts of natural defense mechanisms that doctors have. And I, early in my training, I made some real errors because I was so smart, if I couldn't figure it out, then clearly the patient was either faking or they were hysterical or they were mental, and it was a manifestation of depression. And I think probably every woman out there who's ever had an illness and gone to a doctor is nodding their head saying, yeah, initially they didn't believe me. And it really is a thing. We have plenty of data that shows that even women doctors discriminate against women when it comes to believing them. And after making, as I said, a few rather embarrassing clinical errors, like, for example, missing cancer of the spine because the patient's back pain got worse with lying down, which turns out to be a classic symptom of cancer of the spine, although I didn't know it at the time. Yeah, you learn by messing up in medicine, so mea culpa, but here's my penance. I now have a little mantra, which is believe the patient. The patient is telling the truth. They're not necessarily, you know, if they're telling you they're in pain, they may not be drug-seeking. They may actually be cure-seeking. They may actually be in pain, even though the pain doesn't make any sense to you. And I want to just kind of point out disease clusters. Let's go back to Lyme disease. And so when people first started talking about Lyme disease, it was because there were clusters of juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, which is just weird. And it was, oh, well, that's just a statistical anomaly. It took a very long time to get the CDC to actually look at it and say, I wonder if there actually is a disease here. And because of the nature of Borrelia burgdorferi, the Lyme disease entity, and the fact that it is caused by a vector, it was hard to figure out. And it's even harder to figure out when you have a well-funded drug company going out and doing counter propaganda, because that's what they were saying. This is propaganda. This is just internet memes. Don't believe it. So what finally happened is lots and lots of people were up in arms. So the ANSMA, that is the National Agency for Drug Safety, went ahead and, or Agence Nationale, et cetera, they went ahead and they got the data from Merck. And they put all the bioequivalence data, all of the numeric graphs for the study, up on the website. But, and this, those of you who are computer people will get this, they put it up in image format. So not in a digital format that could be used for statistical reanalysis. So what the researchers then had to do, and these were people at the University of London, in France, they had to go through this huge, thick file of individual patient data and do what they call ant work. They basically had to take hundreds of pages, print them out from a PDF, I presume a PDF, and then spend several days copying all of these into a spreadsheet and then have someone else check the spread that the spreadsheet was correct. And then they did a reanalysis. And this gave them a major surprise, which is to say that it wasn't plus or minus 10%. And in fact, nearly 60% of individuals who were in that trial were outside of the bioequivalence band, meaning that their T4 was more than 10% with the new drug as it had been with the old drug. More or less, and I don't know the directionality of this, so let's be specific. So let's take a moment and talk about lying with statistics. It's really important as a sophisticated consumer that you understand lying with statistics. So we've all heard of the average, all right, and most of you probably have heard of grading on the curve. So let me just give you a thought problem. I have two classes of 30 students, and they have exactly the same average score on a test. But the problem is that in one class, 30 of the students got a C on the test, C average, right? And in the other class, 15 got an A and 15 got an F. Hey, still a C average. This test must be pretty valid, right? Because both classes had a C average on it, so we're going to go ahead and use this for... No, we're not. We're going to take a look at how is it that all these people got A's? Did they cheat? How is it that all these people got F's? Is it that everybody who got a C cheated and they copied the wrong person's test results? You see, you can't take an average outcome and apply it to an individual case. And in the case of medicine, an average outcome on a drug trial is meaningless. Meaningless when you're talking about an individual patient. In functional medicine, we have a saying, a man with one foot on a hot plate and 1 foot on an ice cube is comfortable. Yeah. So we have to use a different attitude when we're talking about drugs. One patient death that was unnecessary because of poor surveillance, because of bad data, should make all of us extremely angry. And I also want to just point out that there is a lot of individual variation in the way that we activate and process drugs. This is something I talk about all the time. And we have had for more than 10 years, close to 20 years now, data that we could and should be using to decide what drugs to give our patients. But it's never gotten any traction in medicine. And, you know, when I talk to pharmacists even, and I say, you know, this patient has a 2D6 mutation, you know, what painkiller should I be giving them, or what antidepressant is going to work best for them? You know what? They're like, I don't know, let me go check the database. But they really don't even have a sense for this, which is crazy. They are the people who should be watching this. Anesthesiologists, same problem. It's not on their radar, and it should be, because this is not news. This is old information. Is it expensive to test? Not really. You can weaponize your 23andMe and get this information about your drug detoxification. We could be doing these tests as part of a one-time physical, one time when a patient in their life, just like we have to have a hepatitis C test if we're a baby boomer, because there's a lot of hepatitis C out there in that age group. Fine, one time lifetime test, we check it, we know what your detoxification vulnerabilities are, and that's part of your record. And we can look at that when we prescribe a drug, and it'll be, oh, this could be a potential interaction. This person can't activate this drug. This person can't break down this drug. Here are some other drugs that you should be giving them or considering giving them. You know, that's a much better basis for a choice of prescription than wandering out to the sample cupboard and seeing what you've got on hand that you can give a bag of to the patient to see if it works okay, which is, honest to God, how people practice medicine in the 21st century. And it's nuts. If you'd like to learn more about drug detox, I'm going to just reference my website again. Sorry, but we've been building this resource for over 20 years at this point, and I like people to visit and use it. If you go to the archives, you can find 2 hours of excellent discussion, if I say so myself, about detoxification. We run this periodically when I take a trip because it is such important information. April 22nd, 2006, if you just scroll back in the archives, or you can find those interviews and you can listen online or download them, and you are welcome to that. So again, the drug that we're talking about here is levothyrox. This is related to levothyroxine. It's related to Synthroid. And just so you know, when a drug gets reformulated, I think we should be actually running the numbers and not trusting the company to run the numbers for us. And I'm not honest to God, I'm not at all sure that that's happening in this country. Interesting question. And we're going to change topics. I happen to be listening to the radio. I'm sorry, I have to admit, it was a different station. And I came across an interview talking about the prevalence of frenotomy. Now, frenotomy is a procedure that involves fixing tongue-tied children. And what has happened, and I would lay it at the internet, what's happened is that support, in support groups, starts to become conformity. And lots of horror stories and lots of anecdotes, and people just don't think critically and begin to feel pressured. And in the case of frenotomy, what this involves is clipping the tongue of newborn infants whose mothers are having breastfeeding problems. And this is an old, old practice. It dates back probably hundreds of years. In fact, I understand that there's even a reference to it in the Old Testament. So this has been known about for a while. It's a common congenital defect, but it's also not a defect in all cases. And you can't really tell whether it's a defect just by looking at the tongue. You can say, okay, from on a scale of 1 to 10, this is looks like it's major, it looks like it's minor. But because this is a functional problem, you really need to actually look at the infant. And so what's happened is that through the internet and through some very passionate testimonials and also pressure to do the right thing for your baby because you know you need to breastfeed, it's become kind of almost de rigueur to do a frenotomy on your child if you're having trouble breastfeeding. In other words, if your nipples get sore. And we have sophisticated technologies, and this has become a real meme, and it's generated some research. And basically, I'm going to cover some of these stories, but I just want to tell you, this is people are actually being pressured by their support groups to do this as a first approach to breastfeeding issues, and this is not where this belongs. There's been a huge rise in published articles on this in the last few years, and much of these publications are reviews or editorials. They are not randomized controlled trials. And this is financially gainful for the people who do it. And it's, I went to the La Leche website and I was pleased to see that they were a little bit, you know, the first couple of paragraphs were, this is really great for helping if your baby's having trouble gaining weight or having trouble breastfeeding. You know, you should have them checked for a tight frenula or a tongue tie. But when you start reading into, when you start seeing where this has gone, it's really got a terrible dark side. Because if the front of the tongue isn't tied, well, maybe the back of the tongue is tied. So why don't we do a posterior release of the tongue? And this is starting to be a thing. And we're starting to have babies whose tongues are damaged as a result of a well-intentioned but unnecessary surgery. And this should get everybody a little bit worried because it is a meme and memes have power, as we all know. So there are a couple of studies I want to quote. One I want to talk about was a double-blind study that looked at 57 infants mean age 32. And all of them had the condition, the tongue tie, the technical term for that is ankyloglossia, and breastfeeding problems. And they were 32 days old. So the investigators randomized them to either frenotomy or a sham frenotomy. And they had two independent scores. They used independent blinded observers with the latch score and the infant breastfeeding assessment tool. And these are standardized methods of observing overall feeding. And what they saw was really no difference at all. And the mothers really could not tell if their babies had undergone a frenotomy. They couldn't tell from looking at the tongue after it, I guess, it's kind of crazy, but this really doesn't necessarily work. Now, there was an unblinded study, looked at 14-day-old infants, and they found that if you did the frenotomy at 24 hours, 85% of the mothers who had whose babies had had it said that it worked, and this was unblinded. So it means that the mothers knew whether or not they'd had the procedure. If they thought they'd had the procedure, 85 of them said, yeah, it's helping. The control infants in this study, and this was probably a condition for getting into the study, if the mothers did not report improvement, then they got a frenotomy at the 48-hour mark. But this just isn't a thing. And when in a recent study that was very good, they used ultrasound. And they looked at the baby's tongue movements and throat movements, and they measured how well the baby seemed to be sucking and how much milk was being delivered. And here's what this study found. They found that the babies who weren't thriving weren't getting enough milk, although their tongue and their mouth was working just fine. There were very few babies in this group who actually had feeding difficulties because of ankyloglossia. They had the feeding difficulties because their mothers were nervous about their feeding. And when you're nervous, you don't have your letdown and you don't produce a lot of milk. So before you do a frenotomy on a case that is not really obvious, where the tongue is actually distorted in the mouth, get the ultrasound and teach mom to meditate or get her to relax or have her do, don't try to breastfeed when you're in a rush to try to get to work. Just, you have to relax. You have to be in a warm and fuzzy place to breastfeed. And your milk supply depends upon your getting yourself out of the loop of worrying about whether you're making enough milk. Because the answer is, if you're worried about it, you probably aren't. And all you have to do to fix that is stop worrying. So I think we need a really high threshold to be cutting on babies' tongues. And there are all kinds of things. Oh, well, they might have problems with their teeth, and they might have problems with their jaw, and they might have speech problems. And, you know, my mother has told me about my ankyloglossia, which, by the way, I still have. I probably don't have a speech impediment. I never had any problems feeding. And she was pressured by both my grandmother and the doctor to do it, but she just didn't have the heart to do it to her, in her opinion, beautiful, perfect little girl. Thank you, Mom, for holding back, because I really think that we are barking up the wrong tree, and now we have sophisticated technology in the form of ultrasound that can help us not do this to children. I think it's traumatic. I don't think we should be poking needles into babies as much as we do. I certainly don't think we should be clipping their tongues. And don't get me started on circumcision. And I know that for some people, that is a religious issue, and that's fine, freedom of religion and all of that. But speaking as a physician, I just don't think you can get a baby's penis numb. I've done my share of circumcisions in my training, and I know what a pain cry sounds like, and I don't think you can get the penis numb. And even if you do, when the local wears off every time that kid pees, it's going to hurt. So why do we do this? Well, I'd rather this not become a cultural meme or a religious issue. Let's move to an email that we received this week from Roseanne in New Jersey. Roseanne writes, "My brother-in-law was in a hospital with a 105 fever. 3 cultures later, he was discovered to have a soft tissue infection. They just don't know where in the body it stems from. He will be on antibiotics for 2 months. This is his 3rd hospitalization in 3 years, and finally, an infectious disease doctor was able to diagnose it. Any ideas, and have you ever heard of it? Apparently, it's not very common." Okay, so the organism in question is Actinomyces newi, and I'm going to spell that Actinomyces, space, Neuii, because, hey, that's a weird one. There's a good Wikipedia page around it, and there's some good case studies describing it. And effectively, what you need to know about this is more in general about emerging infections. We've always had patients that we couldn't figure out what was wrong with them. And some of our new tools, including the ability to do a DNA fingerprint, is going to make a huge difference. So I would predict that one of our emerging diseases is this whole genus of bacteria, because these are a type of bacteria that are anaerobic. And anaerobic bugs are destroyed by oxygen. They're very, very hard to culture. You basically have to put them in an environment where the oxygen levels are very low. That means you have to have a sealed environment and pump the oxygen out. That's hard to do, technically, when you're trying to grow these things in a culture. Now, we do it, but it's tricky, and it's really tricky if you're getting it, if you're biopsying pus from blood. You can keep the oxygen away and get the thing into a low oxygen environment. But if you're talking about the regular culture nets that we use, they're going to miss a lot of infections. I won't get to, I don't want to get super technical on you, except to talk about this Actinomyces genus, which is a, it's a class of bacteria, and these bugs look like fungus. The name is similar to actinomycetes, and these look like fungus because they are on under a microscope, and they form branches. So they look like tree roots almost, and they're a soil organism, and they are ubiquitous. And when I was studying infectious disease, lo, these many years, one of the groups that would get this particular bug was gardeners and people who were digging in the soil. They have one characteristic which makes them easier to spot, if you will, and they form something called sinus tracts. So in cases of superficial infection, say a boil on the buttocks, what you'll see is little basically new channels erupting around the edge of the boil and draining material. And so that's your clue that you have this infection. They generally do respond to most of the existing beta-lactam antibiotics. But if you have to be on in a case where you don't know where the infection is, it could be in bone, it could be in the sinuses, it often is in the sinuses or in the face. It could be sitting in a salivary gland, anywhere where the oxygen tension is low enough that it isn't being poisoned. It's very rare in women's in the pelvic disease, but it has been. It is a potential complication of IUDs, and you have to get the IUD out, of course, and lots of antibiotics. In terms of long-term antibiotic therapy, it's super important to support that microbiome. And one of the best ways to avoid getting the most dreaded complication of long-term antibiotic therapy, which is a C. difficile infection, is to take certain probiotics, particularly a fungus called Saccharomyces boulardii, which we have talked about before, and I won't go into a lot of detail. But what I want to say is, you can be proactive. You can eat fermented foods. You can, you know, eat yogurt and sauerkraut every day. You can take probiotic pills, and I generally recommend 50 billion to 100 billion while you're on the antibiotics, not taken at the same time as the antibiotics. And just in terms, just to get a sense for volume, and gastroenterologists often use a very, very high colony-forming unit probiotic called VSL, which is expensive, but it is sometimes paid for by as a pharmaceutical, so that's why they use it, because they've been detailed by the drug reps that it exists and that it's good. It's a little bit high-end, and I don't use that except on people who are taking antibiotics for reasons that have to do with inadvertently seeding the small intestine with more bacteria than it can handle and creating yet another problem. And indeed, that is a problem sometimes with the treatment of this small intestinal system, but I'm not going to launch into that because we have other interesting stories to cover tonight. Last week, there was a huge heat wave in Europe, and in the south of France, they got up to 114 degrees Fahrenheit. There was, back in 2003, a major heat wave in France. It lasted 2 weeks, and it's estimated that 15,000 people in France died as a direct result of the heat, and 70,000 throughout Europe. This heat wave only lasted 4 days, and it'll take a while to figure out how many extra people died, and it's really not a determinate number, but they just basically look at what the normal death rate is, and then they look at the excess death rate, and they call that, well, that's what happened. Let's talk a little bit about our own physiology and what happens when we're in a hot situation. First of all, if you're outside in the sun, and the or even inside and the temperature rises, there's sunlight hitting your skin, and that's going to warm you directly. The way if you leave a metal plate out in the sun and then touch it, it's warmed by those rays from the sun. There's also air temperature, and that's going to warm you as well. And as the warmer blood from your skin moves towards your core, it starts to raise your body temperature. And a location in your brain called the hypothalamus sends out a whole bunch of behaviors that then show up throughout your body. So the first thing that happens is you start to sweat. And the sweat then evaporates in the heat, and that cools the blood down, and that process then stays in its loop. You sweat just enough to keep your core temperature where it should be, around 98.6. But let's suppose it's humid. Well, then your sweat isn't evaporating because the delta between the moisture in the air and the moisture on your skin isn't great enough to cool you down. So then your heart starts to beat faster. And what it's doing then is it's just trying to get the hot blood out of the center, because your brain and your heart don't do well with increased temperature. And your nervous system in particular hates to run a fever. That's why people get delirious when their temperature gets to like 104 or C's. At this point, your skin is going to start turning red. And this is the beginning of heat exhaustion. Now, if you're older, in response to the chemical signals, for example, epinephrine, norepinephrine and epinephrine from the hypothalamus, your blood vessels may not be able to produce the local nitric oxide to dilate and relax. So instead, you can't get rid of the heat, which puts a stress on your heart. Now, if you're already have heart condition, you can see how difficult this would be. Trying to ride your bicycle up a steep hill with congestive heart failure is not a good idea. And there are some drugs that really interfere here. Diuretics, beta blockers, and certain antidepressants make it even harder for your body to cope with heat. So you can really get into trouble quickly. So what to do? Well, first of all, you better drink water. And you better add some salts and some electrolytes. Please don't drink oral rehydration fluid or sports drinks as your sole matter of rehydrating, because what's going to happen is you're going to concentrate your electrolytes in this situation. So for every Gatorade, 12 ounces of whatever sport drink is your drink du jour, you should probably drink about 16 to 32 ounces of free water and let your kidneys figure it out, rather than thinking that you know best, because you know what? You don't. How much? Well, one suggestion that certain doctors make is to figure out your body's response. Weigh yourself when you're cool and hydrated, and then go out and exercise in hot water for a unit of time, say 30 minutes of walking out in the sun, and then weigh yourself again. And you'll need a liter of water for every 2.2 pounds of water weight that you lost. Here's another thing. If the temperature is above 95, a fan is not going to work, because what it's going to do is blow warm air on you. It's actually going to act like a convection oven. I did not know this. It makes sense, but it never occurred to me. So if you're going to do the fan, you probably want to put the old-fashioned bowl of ice cubes in front of the fan, or keep the fan wet so that you've effectively got a swamp cooler. And whatever you do when it's hot, don't drink alcohol. That really interferes with your brain's ability to regulate the core temperature. And it can come on very suddenly. So here's what you watch for. If you're getting into trouble, you're going to get cramps, you're going to get a rapid pulse, and you're going to sweat profusely, and you might even feel lightheaded. If that happens, first thing, go flat. Secondly, lie down in a pool, get ice on your head, on your armpits, or your groin, because this is where the big blood vessels come close to the surface, and you can actually get the blood cooler. When your body temperature gets that, this is heat exhaustion. You're going to feel really tired, and this is very close to heat stroke. Heat stroke, you're going to stop sweating. So if someone is hot and dry to the touch, you need to worry about that person, and they're going to need a 911 call and ice in all of those areas. They might tell you they have a headache, but their skin's going to be red, hot, and dry, very bad. they'll get confused. They need IV fluids, and they can go into renal failure very quickly if they don't get assistance. Who's most vulnerable? The elderly, children, and people with medical conditions. Last week, two French cyclists died. One was competing in a race. The race was called off as several other cyclists became ill from the heat, but this guy actually died. Back in 2003, on one day, 2,000 people died in France. These were people who lived in apartments without air conditioning, and they just couldn't get cool. Cooling centers are often set up in cities. You should check for that. If you're having problems regulating your temperature or you feel like you might be getting heat exhaustion, you don't want to wait until you stop sweating. You know, speaking of swamp coolers, I spent summers for 3 years in San Bernardino where 114 was not particularly unusual. At least 3 or 4 days in a typical summer. And often temperatures above 100 for days at a time, just like they had in France. Swamp coolers work really well in dry air. And so I'll tell you, it really, really made a difference. I just want people to watch it, because don't try to be an Iron Man when the temperature's in the 90s. That's not the time to push it, unless you're swimming, in which case you can push all you want because the water's going to suck all that excess heat away from your body. Our next story delves into some molecular science because I love to take a deep dive at least one point during this program. And those of you who are friends, let's call them friends of the brew, which is to say people who are beer connoisseurs, will probably love this. Because hops turns out to be an anti-diabetes agent. Now, the problem with beer, of course, is it's got grain in it, not just hops. And so there are other compounds that produce too much glucose. So I'm not recommending beer for diabetics. In fact, of all the alcohols, that's probably the worst one a diabetic can drink, because there's leftover carbohydrate that causes insulin secretion. Alcohol per se does not raise insulin levels. So this study looked at a particular component of hops, which is KDT501. I'm sure that when it goes to drugs, becomes a drug, it'll have a catchier name. But the interesting thing about the hops and the bitter taste is that we have bitter taste receptors in our small intestine. In fact, we have a lot of them. And this is why you should eat your vegetables, particularly the bitterer vegetables, if you're diabetic, because it stimulates the bitter taste receptor, and which is called TAS2, and you get increased secretion of GLP-1, which enhances glucose tolerance. It makes you more sensitive. And you can give a drug called sitagliptin. This is an inhibitor of the enzyme that breaks down GLP-1, and you get a synergistic effect with the hops. So this is just waiting to be a drug. I can just see it coming to a pharmacy near me soon. However, at this point, the research is mostly being done in mice that I've seen published, but it is... they've identified the receptor. They've identified the specific molecule that works best on this. By the way, the mice that were treated with this KDT501 had weight loss. They lost fat mass. They had increased energy, enhanced glucose tolerance, enhanced insulin sensitivity, normalized the plasma levels, and had a broad suppression of inflammatory markers. It also altered the enteroendocrine hormone levels, that is to say the gut to pancreas hormone levels, and it changed the way that the liver was handling bile acids. So I would also bet this probably would be an anti-gout agent in many people who suffer from gout who are not overproducers but are just under excreters. I would expect this to work for certain patients with gout. Looking forward to seeing it. someday, not in the not too distant future. This stimulate the bitter taste receptors may actually substitute for people who hate vegetables because they have extra bitter taste receptors in their tongue. And that group of people, they're called super tasters, by the way, have increased rates of cancer. And that's, well, pretty amazing. Recent research that just came out that is pretty interesting. This was in the June 27th, 2019, detection of brain activation in unresponsive patients with acute brain injury. So I'm just going to read from the abstract. They did long-term EEG monitoring. So they kept the people on an EEG, and then they had a computer hooked up to the EEG. And these are patients who were clinically unresponsive. That means a high Glasgow coma scale. These are people where Annie, wake up doesn't work, where you take your knuckles and you rub them really hard on their breastbone and they don't wiggle or move or do anything, where you pinch their, where you take your reflex hammer and pinch the base of their thumb, which really hurts, by the way, and they don't withdraw. They don't have a reflex withdrawal. So these are people where we're really worried, and we do an EEG to see if they're actually brain dead. But these are really unresponsive patients. So by doing the machine learning and applying it to EEG recordings used to detect brain activation, what they asked was they would give people the command, move your head, move your head. And a certain percentage of the people would actually try to do that. So let's see, 16 patients had brain activation. Of those, 8 of them, 50%, improved such that they were able to follow commands before discharge. And so what we're talking about is we're talking about a study that showed that EEG recordings and response to voice could be potentially useful in deciding if a person is going to have a higher chance of recovery. But now we're going to talk about an estimate. This is coming out of Weill Cornell Medical College in New York. Dr. Nicholas Schiff has been researching chronic vegetative state. And these are people who will not wake up. And some of these people have covert consciousness. That's what we're talking about with the EEG. So some of the time they're awake and some of the times they're not, but they can't move their body. And in 2006, Dr. Schiff discovered that a woman who was in a vegetative state could imagine things on request. They used functional MRI, and they would tell her to imagine that she was walking. And then they found that the parts of her brain that would be activated, we know this, they're activated in everybody when you walk, were in fact the parts of her brain that lit up. And this is really, really fascinating. Some people have what they call covert consciousness. And that's what that is. They've also looked at PET scans. There's this woman called Kate who was left in a vegetative state by a virus. They showed her pictures of her family and played familiar speech. And her brain responded. This is way back in 1997. We've already talked about that woman. And so they started scanning the brains of people that had severe injuries and were seemingly unconscious. And of 8 people who had no behavioral evidence, 4 could follow instructions and imagine something. So now I'm going to tell you about a guy named Louisville Joan. He had a terrible head trauma back in 1996. And this is all very anecdotal, but he was in a coma. He'd been in a coma for 3 years, and he was at his nursing home, and his mother thought he looked restless. She called the doctor, and the doctor said, well, you know, let's give him an Ambien to calm him down. Well, the Ambien actually did the opposite. 15 minutes after his first Ambien, the patient 15 minutes after his first Ambien, he woke up, opened his eyes, and said, "Hi, Mom." Now, can you imagine what this got people doing is giving Ambien to all of these people? Only about 4 out of 84 patients responded, but there are some people who to this day use a little bit of Ambien to wake up their loved ones, and unfortunately, the effect appears to attenuate over time. There's another drug called apomorphine. It's used in people who have Parkinson's disease, and some of them respond and wake up. So there appears to be some circuitry in the brain that is hibernating, and that you can wake them up if you use it. Schiff's team did a study where they put electrodes in the thalamus of a man. They got at the end of 6 months after the trial, he'd been in a minimally conscious state for 6 years. 6 months after the electrodes started to stimulate the thalamus, he could eat, speak, and watch a movie. Now people are doing the same thing using low-intensity ultrasounds, which is non-invasive. They can stimulate the brain, in the front of the brain, the prefrontal cortex appears to be the sweet spot, and people will wake up, and this, of course, also improves their recovery. There's studies going on in the vagus nerve. There's studies going on with all sorts of stimulators, but I like the idea of non-invasive transcranial stimulation. We talked about this last week or the week before, talking about thinking caps and how wearing one of these helmets could actually make a difference. In the initial experiments using this, 1 day of brain stimulation over the forebrain allowed 2 patients out of 55 to open their eyes and start to move their eyes and head to respond. And when they stopped doing this, it took a week for the patients to lose consciousness again. So maybe people who are so deeply comatose that it seems hopeless might actually be able to be revived. So now that we have a way of communicating, the researchers have been wondering if people with covert consciousness, could they give consent? Could they be asked whether they want to live and continue to live like this? Or could they be... So could we say to someone, all right, wave your arms around for yes and run for no. And can you say yes? Okay, but that part of the brain lights up. No? Okay, that part of the brain lights up. Shall we keep you alive? Interestingly, people who are asked this, who are locked in and can't communicate, there was a small survey, and they asked them if they were happy, and they said they were. And oddly enough, very paradoxically, the longer they had been locked in, the happier they were. So do we know what a life, a pure life of the mind is actually like? Are they in some luminal state, kind of maybe like what you get when you're having a good trip on a hallucinogen? Maybe this is not such a bad place to be. An interesting existential question that we'll have to wait to answer. In the meantime, we're going to go to our caller, and that is Kathy in Santa Cruz. Just a moment, Kathy. You're on the air. Hello.
Hi. I have somebody I know has a problem. It's called collagenous colitis.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I was just wondering if you know about that and if you have any, like, recommendations for it. It's like chronic diarrhea, watery, like very watery diarrhea.
Right. So it's a chronic diarrhea. So the first problem is just staying adequately hydrated. And, you know, colitis means inflammation. These are always people who have an inflammatory issue as part of what's going on. And we struggle with understanding the physiology. The collagenous part means, well, okay, you know how when if you have a herpes or you have poison oak and it's really bad, and it's blistering, and you will have this kind of crusty material that forms. You'll see it in impetigo in children, too. Sometimes if you have a bacterial infection of the eye, you'll get the crusting. This is basically liquid collagen. that has dried out, and now what you're looking at is, you know, largely a protein goo or a protein crust. And so we, from a functional medicine standpoint, there's some clues here. It's rarely reported in children. It's commonly reported in middle-aged adults. And it's a type of inflammatory bowel disease. And, you know, what we know from biopsy, you get a layer of thick collagen crusting in the colon, and it interferes with you absorbing your nutrients and absorbing your water. So it's kind of clogging the filter, hence the diarrhea. It's also going to cause a lot of nutritional abnormalities. So your friend will have, should be getting tested for micronutrients as part of his ongoing, as part of his ongoing therapy. What, as a functional medicine doctor, what I do is I assume that this is some sort of immune-driven thing related to something that's in the colon. So my go-to bag of tricks is I get a 16S RNA breakdown of the stool, which is a which is a test that can be done by, there are multiple labs that do that, Genova, Doctors Data, a few others, Great Smokies Laboratories do this. And there's also, there's a couple of other companies, but some of them I don't really like for various reasons. So those are the ones that I would prefer to recommend. And I received absolutely no kickback or anything. This is a non-commercial endeavor on my part. So I feel like I can, you know, you're not applying for CME credits, so I can be commercial. This would require stool specimens or just diarrhea specimens. Probably not hard to obtain in your friend. And then you look and see what odd, whether there are odd or unusual volumes of certain bacteria that the immune system might be trying to kill, but in its, in the process, it's created an immune storm that's causing scarring. You know, just like when your body tries to heal from a scar and you get a keloid, like a super scar. You've seen keloids, right? Well, imagine that mechanism, the scar tissue formation is stuck on high when it really needs to be on low. And that's kind of how this works. So you have to remove the you know, what's the needle, what's the thumbtack in the foot? We got to find the thumbtack in the foot that's triggering the problem. And so I also check blood for food sensitivities and food allergies. And I take all of, I take the person off of any food that they have antibodies against. And sometimes in this situation, I even have to put people on what's called an elemental diet. So at this point, you're just eating amino acids and fat and some form of glucose. It is not tasty, but it gets rid of the irritation, and sometimes you can damp this thing down. It's definitely better to try this than condemn a person to long-term steroids, which is the other issue that we sometimes encounter. So
yeah,
I just
he tried that.
So we're coming up on
that.
Yeah,
and it didn't really.
Yeah,
work.
No, and also it's not a good long-term solution. We're coming up on the end of the program, and I'm really sorry because I wish you had called earlier. Feel free to call back next week, and we can continue the conversation. But you might want to have your friend listen and let him know when you're calling in.
Okay, that sounds good. Thank you so much.
All right, Kathy. Bye for now.
Bye bye.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.